The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 353, Reflecting on the Death Penalty as a Mormon, by Kenneth Driggs. Staff attorney for the Texas Resource Center, and he'll discuss in this paper his experiences with these men and other defendants, and how he's been left with deep doubts about the traditional Mormon view of capital punishment as a good thing. We will hear a response to his paper from Kay Gillespie, who's chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Weber State University, and who was the author of a book a few years ago called The Unforgiven, Utah's Executed Men. And our chair for this session will be Jill Remington, and we will go to her now for introductions.
My name is Jill Remington. I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's session of Sunstone, and hopefully the lights will hold for us. I'd like to remind all of you that admission to the session is by name tag or ticket only. I'd like to introduce today Ken Driggs, who will be reading to us his paper, Reflections on the Death Penalty as a Mormon. Mr. Driggs is a death row lawyer in Texas and has also defended death row cases in Florida. He's a sixth-generation Mormon and has done a lot of writing about Mormon cases. Most recently, he's been researching and writing about fundamentalist Mormons. He assures me, though, he's not a fundamentalist and only has one wife. Commenting on his paper is Kay Gillespie. He's the chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Weber State University and author of The Unforgiven, Utah's Executed Man. Listeners have told me that they'd like to leave lots of time for comments and feedback at the end of this session. It's an hour session, and I'll turn the time over now to Mr. Driggs.
Actually, I've promised a manuscript that's a further development of this to dialogue, and it's very important to me to get some feedback from people. I think I'm going to touch on some topics that you'll probably want to hear more about, so I'm trying to leave plenty of time for that. I've also put a few handouts up here in front that relate to some of the things I'm going to be talking about. I want to start with a couple of general comments, which is that I don't want anything I say here today in my personal opposition to the death penalty to mean that I'm not sensitive to the suffering of people who are killed and the families of people who are killed. I think it's essential that that come out. There's nobody has a right to take anybody's life, and I don't want what I say to be misinterpreted on that point. And also, by saying that I think we should do away with the death penalty, I'm not saying that I think we should do away with responsibility for homicide. I'm personally not troubled by life in prison without parole for appropriate offenses. Frankly, I think if more states went to that, we would see fewer death sentences because of a public fear about parole. I've been thinking about my own reactions to the death penalty as a Mormon for 4 years, a little over 4 years, which is about the period of time that I've been doing exclusively death row work. I only know of one other death row Mormon attorney, at least active Mormon, and that's a public defender in Tallahassee, Florida, named Dave Davis. And we've talked about this a good bit. It's always sort of been in the abstract for me until a situation I had this winter that I want to begin talking about a little bit. It all changed with this guy. He was a client of mine who I will call James Frederick, who was executed by the state of Texas. Jimmy was an admitted armed robber. He was quite candid about that. This in spite of the fact that he grew up in what appeared to me to be a pretty loving, supportive, and deeply religious family, which, believe me, in my line of work is very much an exception. He was convicted of shooting a man in the course of a robbery. It was a bad murder, but in the sort of ladder of murders, it was not nearly as bad as a great many I see. It was one of the least offensive of the cases that I've handled. Jimmy's appeals took about 8 years leading up to the time of his execution. And in that period of time, he had become a genuinely and sincerely religious individual. You see a lot of fake religiosity in this business, but this is a guy who had genuinely become a spiritual individual. The pastor of the church where he'd grown up had stayed in pretty constructive relationship, contact with him through the period of his incarceration. And he had a mother who loved him very dearly and stayed in touch with him. This stuff is awfully emotional. Don't ever think that lawyers don't feel this. She would visit him regularly, wrote him, other members of the family came up with him. And he also had a small child who was born about the time he was taken into custody, and he'd done his best to maintain a relationship, a positive relationship with that child in the period of his incarceration. Well, as the appeals wound down, we all recognized, and Jimmy in particular recognized, the reality of his situation. Before I get to that, I wanted to mention that he had been a pretty model inmate in the prison. He was very involved in a unique death row work program that they have in Texas. The guards regarded him as not a threat, not someone they had to be particularly concerned about. They relaxed a number of the security requirements on Jimmy that they normally maintained on other people. And in general, his prison life defied any characterization of him as being someone beyond redemption, who had no further value as a human being. But then he reached what we call successor status in my business, which means that you have exhausted your first two normal set of appeals in capital cases and you're going through federal habeas corpus for the second time. And in Texas, that pretty much means you're not going to survive. He knew he had reached that point. He was prepared. He was scared of dying, but he was at peace with God, I thought. And also during this period of time, I had almost daily contact with his mother and developed a pretty close bond with her. And I found in her a mother's heart. She was unquestioningly loving of him. She was in indescribable anguish and fear of this coming up, and shed a great many tears through this, which I was privy to. I remember at one point the newspapers in her hometown quoted the mother of the victim in this case as being very angry that Jimmy had not been executed sooner. She thought that he was a monster, used a lot of very hostile terms about him, and was angry that Texas law did not allow her to witness the execution of this man who had killed her son. And I remember Jimmy's mother being pretty bitter about the press. In Texas, they had significantly increased the pain that she went through. But she could not be bitter about this other woman. I remember her telling me that she's a mother, too. I understand what she's feeling. And on the last day, the way executions work in Texas, the condemned are kept in a prison unit called the Ellis One Unit, and the death chamber is in downtown Huntsville in another prison called the Walls Unit. Jimmy's mother, his 7-year-old child, a couple of sisters, and some other relatives visited with him until about 4 o'clock when they terminate the visiting and they transport you to the death chamber. I was not able to be with him because we had some appeals remaining in the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a pretty last-gasp effort, and I had to remain in my office in Austin and await the phone call, which we anticipated what it was going to be, but I still had to be there to do what we could. And about 8:30 that night, I got a call from Cynthia Rapp, who is the capital clerk in the U.S. Supreme Court, and she told us that we had been denied 8-1. And I had to call Jimmy and tell him. He was in the holding cell outside the execution chamber. And we talked for about 20 minutes. And then he asked me to get in touch with his family, who were in a hotel, and we hooked up a conference call. I was in Austin, Jimmy was in the death chamber, and his family was in the hotel room, and they were passing the phone from one to another. And first his mother, and then his son and his sisters. And it took about 90 minutes for him to tell them goodbye. Boy, this is just like testimony meeting. I always swear I'm not going to do this. At any rate, it was the most excruciating 90 minutes I have ever been through. And then we hung up. The condemned in Texas is allowed to designate a couple of individuals as witnesses. There are official witnesses to the execution. And he wanted his mother and a sister to be there. And his mother just could not do this. And when we hung up the phone, she couldn't assure him that she would do it. And then she did. She went. Executions are set in Texas for 12:01 a.m. right after midnight, and by tradition they have to be completed by dawn. If you survive till dawn, they have to set another date. And he was dead by about 12:20 in the evening, and his mother was there. And the next morning she called me and asked me if I would speak at his funeral sermon, which I dreaded doing, but it ended up being one of the most positive, validating experiences I've ever done. I'm really glad to have had that opportunity. So that whole experience drove home to me. I've had other clients executed, but I don't know that I've ever had quite the close connection with a client and his family as I did in that situation. And I came away with this sense of how evil the death penalty was, how much suffering, how much it expanded the ring of pain, and that there had to be another way for us to be dealing with this. So I've looked at it very differently since that case. My personal opposition to the death penalty comes, and this is sort of the non-religious stuff, and I think these are legitimate concerns. For starters, we do have, I think, the best judicial system in the world, but it is not perfect. We do convict innocent people from time to time, and we do put innocent people on death rows from time to time. Every year, two, three, four people sometimes are identified on a death row somewhere as innocent, and they are released. But they are not all found. We have executed innocent people, and we have executed innocent people recently. I think that is something we shouldn't tolerate. One of the most chilling rationalizations to me I've ever seen in the literature in support of the death penalty is some scholar who's got it computed down to a certain percentage of innocent executions, which is tolerable and acceptable level of execution of innocence in order for us to enjoy the benefits of the death penalty, which I just really disagree with. I also believe that the death penalty is becoming increasingly arbitrary in its application. Increasingly, the people who get death as opposed to the people who get life don't have so much to do with the facts of the crime and the individual culpability of the defendant as they have to do with the sort of varying factors of politics, race of the victim, racial composition of the juries, just simple geography. I know in the state of Texas, where you commit the murder is one of the largest indicators of whether you'll get a death sentence or not. And in virtually every state, the race of the victim is one of the largest predictors of whether you'll get death. And it's killing white people is what gets you death sentence. It is not killing minorities. And I think one of the inevitable results of this increasing arbitrariness of the death penalty is that it does become racist. If you look at the statistics from around the country, it is very much disproportionately applied to racial minorities and outsiders, and I think that's a legitimate concern. The current Supreme Court has, unbelievably to me, held that racism does exist in our capital punishment system, and the word they use is it's inevitable, but it's not a fatal blemish on the system, and they've been prepared to tolerate it. I also think the death penalty is bad public policy. It costs, the figures I've seen are anywhere from half to three-quarters of $1 million to incarcerate somebody for life, whereas executions are running around $3 million each. And there's really, I don't think, any real discussion about whether the death penalty is actually a deterrent to crime. The kind of people who commit the acts that get the death sentence are just not very often deterred by those kinds of rational concerns. So I think we are probably executing more out of fear and revulsion of these individuals. We're scapegoating in a way more than out of some rational process. I don't believe that society should be blamed for individual human failings, but I do believe that a great many people who end up on death row live lives that clearly signaled this was coming unless some positive force intervened. The violent battering of children, the sick sexual molestation of children, the scourge of drunkenness and addiction among parents, drug abuse, and an even more destructive use of chemical inhalants by children and young adults, lack of parenting skills, a lot of other things can pretty much tell us what children are being put on a path that are likely to make them my client one day. And we're not very good at addressing those issues. I acknowledge that a substantial majority of Mormons support the death penalty. Certainly that's the case in my ward in Austin, Texas, and my former ward in Tallahassee, Florida. I'm definitely a minority view. And it seems to be little doubt that the church, at least, is not opposed to it. I'm reliably told that a section in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism by Stuart W. Hinckley, which is accurate, which says, quote, capital punishment is viewed in the doctrines of the church to be an appropriate penalty for murder, but that penalty is proper only after the offender has been found guilty in a lawful public trial by constitutionally authorized civil authorities. I note a section in Spencer W. Kimball's book, The Miracle of Forgiveness, where he talks about sins unto death and the unpardonable sin. And I'm willing to recognize that there are certainly those capital offenders who would fall in that category. But turning to the religious aspects here now, For me, the most unique doctrinal features of Mormonism are those that stress individual responsibility. That includes the rejection of original sin, which I personally consider a really central, important Mormon doctrine. Free agency, the belief that baptism should not come until age 8 or until an age of moral accountability, when people have the ability to make these rational, ethical, moral choices. We are each judged according to the knowledge and talents we could bring to the temptations and challenges of life. We believe that members of the church are judged by a higher standard because we have a greater knowledge and a more spiritual opportunity in life than many people. The prophet Joseph Smith stated these concepts simply in the second article of faith. We believe that man will be punished for his own sins and not for Adam's transgression. But all of these doctrines presume rational thinking people who enjoy some control over their lives. The doctrines are not applied to all individuals without regard to their mental, biological, or environmental circumstances or disabilities. The church's present application of the doctrines in the day-to-day concerns of bishops and missionaries and priesthood leaders, I think, makes this clear that we do make some of these differentiations. This is a recognition that God did not bless us all equally, and that the most challenging decisions we make come in stressful circumstances in life, and we don't always make the right decision. My religious opposition to the death penalty grew with my understanding of just who the people on death rows are. While there are always exceptions, and you should be careful of stereotypes, there are some things which can be said of the great majority of them, certainly the great majority of the 30-odd men that I've been associated with on death rows. These clients are overwhelmingly from single-parent dysfunctional families. Child neglect is the norm. I always thought that the battering of children was a sin, but it wasn't until I got involved in this work that I realized what a high percentage of these children are permanently brain damaged as a result of these battering experiences. Sexual victimization of death row individuals is so common that when defense teams like myself don't find it in our investigation of the case, we think we've overlooked something. It's really unusual not to have it be present. I appreciate how a childhood living in a home where parents are fighting and screaming and battering each other, even if the children are not necessarily the subjects of this, how much being raised in that environment affects you and is carried with you in your relationships and your ability to make judgments and interact with people as an adult. Children who see violence learn violence. That's what it boils down to. I had never encountered fetal alcohol syndrome until I started handling death row cases. The majority of those who were abused carry with them a rage that plays a significant role in their crimes. And I want to drop back for a second here from my text and mention a book that is probably in your local bookstores called Shot in the Heart by Michael Gilmore, who is a younger brother of Gary Gilmore, who you may recall was executed in Texas in 1977. I'm only about halfway through it, but it's kind of a family biography of where someone who ended up at that point might come from. And it's really excellent, I think. It makes the point of how these environmental factors just steadily accumulate on someone and begin to bring about this individual who eventually becomes one of my clients. In reading that book, I'm just seeing things I recognize through virtually every case that I've handled. So it's a book I really strongly commend to you. Another factor, my death row clients were almost all in the grasp of some sort of significant drug abuse or substance abuse, not only at the time of their crime, but for an extended period of time before. One of the surprises to me is how many of them are huffers, as we call them, paint and glue and other petrochemical substance sniffers, getting high in the course of that, which causes just awful brain damage. It's a very common phenomenon. It seems to be more common in Texas, actually, even than I saw it in Florida. By almost any measure, these people, death row populations, have lived on the margins of society. They are the underclass living out pathetic, inadequate lives. The typical death row inmate dropped out of school in the 8th or 10th grade if they stayed in that long. They rarely have a stable employment history, stable relationships with anyone, or anything that you could call success of any kind in their lives. It's always possible to hold up a Ted Bundy, who's sort of the poster child of death penalty proponents, But Ted Bundy's are very much the exception on death rows. I've certainly never represented anyone approaching Ted Bundy. Just as a sort of a little unscientific abstract, I've been either represented or deeply involved in about 30 death row cases. And I have one guy who made it to college for about a half a year. I have, maybe five high school graduates. I would say no more than six or eight of them were not addicts of some type at the time of the offense. It's just that's the profile that you see. You don't see much success in people's lives. Mormons believe in quality families as a manifestation of the divine. While we are often short on the ideal, the believing Mormon strives for a home that teaches children solid values, especially in interpersonal relationships, by example. We stress this because we know much of this must be learned by children in our complex and difficult society. Church leaders constantly teach us we must counteract the unhealthy messages taught in the world around us. The world is always ready to teach children that violence is a problem-solving skill they should use, that self-absorption and materialism are ways that we should be, that substance abuse is a way to become happy and popular, unfeeling sexuality, and that persons who feel a moral responsibility for the welfare of others are basically chumps. That's, I think, a message that we have to counteract with kids all the time. I doubt that many of us would not feel that the parent who not only neglects to teach their children positive values, but actually teaches them evil, to steal, to lie, to be violent, to be substance abusers, shares some responsibility for the bad acts of their children. One thing that has always amazed me about our society is how quickly our sympathy for abused and molested children is used up. When we learn that this has happened to somebody, we're generally pretty indignant about the perpetrator, and we're very sympathetic for the child and want to sort of take them in and help them. But when those kids grow up and become teenagers and young adults and start acting out in ways that are entirely predictable and likely given the behavior they've had or the experiences they've had, then we lose all sympathy for them. We want to deny that these kids were somehow made, that there's external factors that have come about to make these kids there, and they just we're reluctant to view a sort of moral, ethical, diminished capacity in their situations. Support for the death penalty out of a desire for personal or societal revenge is clearly inconsistent with the gospel. Latter-day Saints must be mindful of President Kimball's admonition that revenge is contrary to LDS teachings. President Kimball wrote in his book, The Miracle of Forgiveness, that, quote, "The spirit of revenge, of retaliation, of bearing a grudge is entirely foreign to the gospel of the gentle, forgiving Jesus Christ," close quote. There are some other sort of Mormon subtopics that relate to the death penalty. I would like to get into at another point, but I've deliberately kind of steered clear of them here today. Blood atonement and issues relating to blacks and the priesthood, I would like to take up in the article, but they're going to have to wait for another day. In closing, I'd like to share with you the thoughts of a Louisiana Catholic nun, Sister Helen Prejean, who wrote a book called Dead Man Walking, which is another book I commend to you. It's she worked with death row inmates and their families and with the families of victims and has written a very personal book about all of that experience. And in her book, she writes, "If someone I love should be killed, I know I would feel rage, loss, grief, helplessness, perhaps for the rest of my life. It would be arrogant to think I can predict how I would respond to such a disaster. But Jesus Christ, whose way of life I try to follow, refused to meet hate with hate and violence with violence. I pray for the strength to be like him. I cannot believe in a God who meets out hurt for hurt, pain for pain, torture for torture. Nor do I believe that God invests human representatives with such power to torture and kill. The paths of history are stained with the blood of those who have fallen victim to God's avengers. Kings and popes and military generals and heads of state have killed, claiming God's authority and God's blessing. I do not believe in such a God." I must agree with Sister Prejean. I simply cannot imagine Jesus Christ participating in an execution, nor should we, as individuals or through our government. Thank you.
I've been trying to do a cause and effect analysis of the lighting here, and I believe I've got it figured out. It gets a little bit brighter when you're right, a little bit darker when you're wrong, and it flashes as a warning. And so I'll try to watch that as I go through, if I have it figured right. This is an important session for Ken and for his paper, and he's asked that I keep my remarks brief since he would like as much feedback from you as possible, and that's not difficult for me. I'm in the process of trying to learn as a professor to take 30 seconds worth of material and stretch it out to 40 minutes, and I've not accomplished that, and I will not be successful at that today either, so you can rest a little easy, Ken. Over the past several years, I have begun my classroom discussions on the death penalty with the following Utah example. A Utah county official was found dead in a back alleyway. He had been robbed of several important documents, including his personal possessions, and had been decapitated. A young man from a prominent family was arrested and confessed he did the killing when he heard a voice telling him to do it. Now, this example, of course, won't fool Sunstone attenders, but I then asked, should this young man be executed? About 80% of my students favor the death penalty in this situation, citing as reasons that those who kill should be killed, some even referring to the outdated concept of blood atonement. The 20% who do not favor the death penalty in this instance rely on the argument against executing those with mental illnesses. All are surprised when I tell them that I have taken the example from the Book of Mormon and that they have just decided to execute Nephi, or decided that he was crazy because he heard voices. This then provides a lively discussion for us to look at capital punishment and what people as Mormons believe should be done in these situations. Today I applaud Ken's efforts to reach a personal position, a stand for himself on the issue of capital punishment. I think there are some significant questions that need to be asked. I think there are questions that need to be asked by each of us. Do I favor capital punishment? Where, when, how, and why? And would I be willing to be the executioner? I have been present at the last three executions in this state. I have studied not only those who were being executed, but those who were awaiting execution, and I have also studied those who did the executing. I have found that it is as difficult to execute as it is to do many other kinds of things, that those who execute do not do it gleefully, but do it very seriously and take very seriously their responsibility. And I have found that distance has come to make a difference as well. My great-grandfather, who conducted one of the first executions in this state, conducted it with a firing squad in Tooele County from about 100 to 125 feet. That seems like a sporting chance to me. Our executions at the current time take place within about 15 feet for firing squads, and of course are much closer for lethal injection and other kinds of things. I sometimes sit through our gospel doctrine classes on the Old Testament, and I am amazed at the indifferent attitudes displayed as we discuss the battle's aftermath, in which the God of the Old Testament commands the victorious armies to kill every living thing in the conquered cities, to, quote, utterly destroy all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, as we read in Joshua. Could I kill a 16-year-old boy or girl? If I really favored capital punishment in these instances, could I kill a young mother or elderly grandmother, even at the command of God? And what would that do to me in terms of the thought processes? And yet we glibly read through these scriptures as though that could be done without any afterthought at all. The death penalty in the abstract is an entirely different matter than the death penalty up close and personal, as the television would tell us. Ken Driggs has experienced that difference, and it has caused him to search for his own position. And as I understand his paper, and he told me just beginning of the meeting that he had rewritten it last night, but I think we're both still quoting from the same paper. If not, Ken, grab me. He has taken a position against the death penalty. He has attempted to define that position within the context of his Mormonism, and he has done so as a result of his personal experience with death row inmates and with their families. His argument against the death penalty as a Mormon rests on his basic assumption about individual responsibility, as he has just told us, which incorporates the rejection of original sin, the doctrine of individual free agency, and the belief that baptism should not occur until an age and state of accountability has been realized, And then Ken tells us that based on this assumption, his Mormonism suggests there are certain segments of our population who are not accountable, those with mental, biological, and environmental disabilities. I'm not sure that's doctrinal, but I think we can probably discuss that later. I am concerned about a society that is diminishing accountability across the board, that is looking for causes of behavior in biology, genetics, all kinds of new syndromes and diseases that we have come up with to explain away individual accountability. Ken then suggests that those on death row fit into these categories that he has suggested. As I've suggested, Ken and I have had similar experiences. Each of us has reached our own individual position, and I think each of us can only speak from that individual position. I am concerned that anyone should misinterpret what should happen here today as any of us attempting to speak for the church. And so I think any time we talk about a definition of Mormonism, that definition of Mormonism is within our own definition of Mormonism rather than speaking doctrinally or from the church. It is my understanding that there is no doctrinal position on the death penalty in the Mormon church. I have asked and have received the most basic definition, which is that the LDS Church believes in the law of the land, and that if it is the law of the land that the death penalty is allowed in Utah, then so be it. If it is not the law of the land that it is allowed in England or other places, then that also is appropriate. And so to me, it seems that that is the only official position that can be taken. Any of us as individuals, however, have an obligation to come to our own conclusions as to what we personally believe. And I'm concerned that many of us do not. And so I'm pleased to be here and pleased that Ken has sort of set the stage by doing so himself. Let me first suggest my concern about getting too close to the death penalty. I become suspicious of people who are in favor of capital punishment from a distance without having had any experience with it. But I become just as suspicious of anyone who becomes opposed to it after having gotten too close to it. I think a certain amount of objectivity is necessary, and I think sometimes we have to balance that out. Now, I'm probably one of those who are lukewarm and who would be the first to be cast out. I'm probably one of those who would be defined as a mugwump with my mug on one end and my wump on the other. And I'm sure it could be argued that I'm taking the easy way out in terms of my personal position on the death penalty, but you probably should know that at this point, and that is that I do favor capital punishment in that I believe the state has the right to determine whatever punishment it wishes. It is the state's obligation to act in the name of society, and in doing so, through the legal process, through the representative process, through the legislative process, a society can determine whatever punishment it wishes for whatever crime, and that becomes the obligation and the right of that society. Ken expressed some support and belief in our justice system. I'm a criminologist, and I have to tell you I have no belief or support for our justice system. It is arbitrary, it is capricious, and I think at the present time, the way it operates, that we cannot trust it to take a life. And so while in principle I support capital punishment in terms of our present system, I have a very difficult time supporting it. Ken had a lot of reasons for that. He left out one of the more interesting from my perspective, and that is the sexism of the death penalty. We want to jump on the racism, and we want to jump on the economic and other kinds of things. We don't often realize that it is also sexist in that it seeks to execute men, not women. Now, that's not a happy position to take at this day and age, but the point is that we execute many more men than we do women, and that women can pretty well kill with impunity in our system. And I'm just completing a manuscript on the executed women in the United States since 1900. There have been about 34 opposed to over 3,000 men. And at some point, we need to sort of look at that. There are states that have never executed a woman and that probably never will execute a woman. And I don't have time to tell you the stories from Utah, but there have been some horrendous crimes committed by women in this state who were not executed and who were not even considered for the death penalty. So in the overall picture, our justice system can be influenced by an awfully lot of factors as we look at it. I'm also a little concerned about a definition of life and death, as though death is the worst of all possible things. Again, within religious teachings, I think we have to look again at what this means. Those who oppose the death penalty, I find, often have too much of a commitment to life and the value of living rather than looking at it in another sense, in some other sense. This commitment to life and the value of living can obscure the meaning and the context of death and its place in defining the value of life. We've been told in scriptures that it is better for one man to die than for a nation to perish in unbelief. President Kemble has talked about tragedy or destiny. We have a great history of martyrdom and the role of the blood of the prophets and others crying up from the dust. All have their place in the eternal scheme of things. And I'm not sure who is qualified to steady the ark. Serving for a brief time as a member of the Utah State Board of Pardons, it was very difficult to decide who should live and who should die. What is the value of a life? Is it 20 years in prison? Is it 12 years in prison? Is it life in prison? And many of the death row inmates I talk to say they would rather be executed than spend their life on death row. Many of those in our prisons who have life sentences tell me they would prefer to have been given the death penalty than to have an ongoing hell day by day that they have to experience. And so which is better, death or life? And I recall one of my conversations just prior to Arthur Gary Bishop's execution, which he told me, I have messed up this life. It's time for me to get on with the next one. Should we, in some doctrinal context, be holding up a person's eternal progression by keeping them alive rather than letting them be executed and get on with the next life and do what needs to be done there? Who are any of us to speak for another? I have an obligation to define things for myself, how I will feel, respond, or evaluate those things for today. It is when we attempt to speak for Mormonism that we create problems. And many of you may be familiar with the situation that is sort of developing in Pocatello, Idaho, where we have a man who has been sentenced to die for the killing of a young girl there, claims that the church held a court in the basement of the jail. I don't know that he claims it. I read this in the newspaper accounts, that they held a high council court in the basement of the jail and excommunicated him, that his attorney, in fact, encouraged him to accept the death penalty so he could atone for his sin. And now this man is raising the issue that maybe he got bad representation and was recommended by some very well-meaning people because of their religious beliefs that he do things that maybe in another light or another time he might not have done. That will be an interesting case to follow. And again, I think the problem is when any of us decide that we can speak for the church, that we can somehow tell other people what the church expects of them in terms of whether they should be executed or how they should account for their sins or atone for them, or any of us speaking for what we believe the position of the church is without knowing that. Many of the misrepresentations and misunderstandings about the Mormon church and the death penalty are the result of those who have attempted to interpret for the church. Now, tomorrow I may gain more insight, more knowledge, more perspective. To me, all positions are tentative. My position on the death penalty today may not be my position on the death penalty tomorrow. I gain new experience, and I gain new energy and new perspective as I develop. And again, I applaud Ken for what he has done. I would ask how we are doing, encourage that we also wrestle with that issue on a personal basis. Thank you.
I'd like to thank both Ken and Kay for their really thoughtful presentations. We have a little over 15 minutes for questions, so maybe we'll just, yes. Can you come up to a microphone? Thank you.
Can I respond from here, or should I come up to
the Whichever you prefer.
These are on.
Are they on? Okay.
I have a question to Gillespie on his comments about the church's position at this point on the death penalty. It seems to me that the church's position is arbitrary and capricious also. If the Supreme Court would rule tomorrow that the death penalty is not a valid attempt to seek justice, then the church would go along with the law of the land.
Again, I am not a spokesman for the church, nor would I attempt to do so, and so I don't know what they would do in that instance. All I know is that when I contacted them for the position of the church, that was the information that I was given.
Does this work?
Okay. I have a question. It seems I got into a discussion, an email discussion, concerning the capital punishment, and it went to the topical guide in the LDS scriptures, and the scriptures that were quoted seem to indicate a pro-capital punishment stance. Would you care to comment on that?
I started out, actually I've been thinking about this paper since before my client's execution, and I started off sort of rummaging around through the scriptures looking for some stuff before that situation came up and drove a different message home to me. But I would agree with you, that's sort of, I get that tenor from the scriptures too, but I also get sort of an opposite thread. You know, I think there's both arguments are present in the scriptures. And the question of this issue of the death penalty in the abstract versus the death penalty in its working application are different kinds of issues. I mean, I think if Dallin Oaks were to leave the church headquarters and decide to go on a Minute Market robbery spree and kill six people in the course of getting $200 out of each store, he would be a much more appropriate candidate for the death penalty than a lot of these guys, because he has had a life not encumbered by all of these disadvantages and disabilities that diminish his ability to make rational judgments about how to live, contrasted with some character with a 70-75 IQ who grew up in a dysfunctional, violent family. I think you can believe that the death penalty is appropriate for those small number of very advantaged individuals who do these things, and still find it very inappropriate for what I see as the great majority of individuals who end up with death sentences on our death rows around the country. So I don't think my opposition to giving the death penalty to those kind of people really runs counter to what the scriptures might hold.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? Basically, does it bother you that the church doesn't take a pro or con stand?
The question is, does it bother me that the church doesn't take a pro or cons?
Kind of takes a morally woozy position.
Well, maybe my concern would be that if they took a stronger position, what it might be. I'm a little reluctant to press somebody to be real vocal on that, given the way I perceive some of the sentiments of church leaders right now. But I don't think it's a monolithic sentiment either. I've gotten some feel that some people, pretty ranking church people, are uncomfortable with it too.
I just wanted to make a brief comment on that. I'm not sure that it's the church's position to take a position. Again, I think the thing that appeals to me is that each individual needs to make a position and take that position and vote that position, to stand up for that position, that it's an individual matter rather than a church matter, and so I'm not sure that that's something that we would expect the church to take a position on.
It seems to me that if there is ever a situation where a religion should take a moral stand, it is in the area of life and death. And our church has certainly taken strong moral stands against abortion, for example. I'm a little troubled by this idea that we're going to accept whatever the law of the land is. And since, Kay, you've said that that's your position as well as the church position, I'll direct this position to you, or this question to you. What if the law of the land is as it is in Arab countries, where a woman can be executed for adultery?
Well, I don't do well with hypotheticals, but I'll try a hypothetical answer.
That's not that's a hypothetical.
Okay. There are a lot of laws in a lot of lands that do a lot of things that we don't agree with. There are a lot of cultures that have different cultural expectations and different cultural punishments. Who makes us God over the whole world? Who makes us God over everybody else's lives? And who says that we in America, I mean, how ethnocentric can you get than to say that our attitude in America about what's right and wrong should be imposed on the rest of the world, and that they should live the way we live, and that their laws should reflect what our laws are? Historically, people have been executed for all kinds of things. I don't know how much of a guilt trip we need to carry for all of that, but there are those definitional things within cultural contexts that I think we must allow to take place. I don't know what's morally right and wrong. Now, Jimmy Carter did. It seems like Clinton is starting to think that. Who are we to talk about human rights worldwide when we don't even have the knowledge about that? Who says that our definition should be the predominant definition? I certainly don't think that I am in that position.
I think there was a question in back. Would you like to come up to the microphone? Do you want... Okay.
This is your paper, and I'm getting all the flash, Tyler. Somebody's going to be a lightning rod.
It's certainly true that it's difficult and probably undesirable to impose our values everywhere. But there's a difference between imposing your values and raising a moral, having a moral outrage for what appears to be, to me, to be very wrong, which is, in the example I was using, taking a life, taking a woman's life for adultery, that it's certainly sexist. Now, that's the example in the scriptures, though, where people could be executed for that. But it seems to me that whether or not a church wants to impose its values, it at least has a responsibility to speak for its values. And that people who have a moral sensibility have an obligation to raise that moral sensibility and not just say, well, whatever society wants is okay.
I'm well aware of what an emotional issue this is, and I don't get any applause, and the other position always does, and that's not a problem for me. I'm very accustomed to that. But again, I think it would be very difficult for a worldwide church serving worldwide cultures to come up with a moral position. That would just be my... We can continue this afterwards if you'd like to.
But the church does take moral position in life and death issues when it comes to abortion and euthanasia, and it refuses to take a moral stance on the death penalty. So I think that's a real inconsistency.
And I don't speak for the church.
I wanted to ask Mr. Gillespie a question also. I believe that the terms that you used were that the death penalty in our country is sexist in that it executes men, but women are allowed to kill indiscriminately. Do you have statistics on the numbers of women who are faced with the death penalty and not given the death penalty in correspondence with the numbers of men? Is this a factual statistic? Do you have facts to back this up, or is this more a reflection of the numbers of crimes that are committed by men who are then faced with the death penalty?
The only statistic I have is that the homicide arrest rate for women has been identical to that of men for about 100 years.
The homicide arrest rate for women is the same as men?
As men.
I might can address that a little bit, too. The way a death penalty trial works, and I think this relates to that question a little bit, they're different from any other kind of trial in that you have two parts to them. The first part is what we call a guilt phase, where the jury determines guilt or innocence of the capital crime. If they come back innocent or guilty of a lesser included offense, that's the end of the trial. But if they come back guilty on the capital offense, you then move into what's called a punishment phase or a penalty phase. And depending on the law in the state, the jury votes either a binding sentence on the trial court or an advisory recommendation on the trial court as to whether this person gets life or death. And in the course of that, you bring in aggravating and mitigating circumstances. A lot of what I'm giving you is legal buzzwords, but it's basically the good stuff and the bad stuff about this person and trying to put them into context. Cultural biases and values come into play in those punishment phases. And juries consciously or subconsciously vote some of those biases. And I think there is a bit of a bias, cultural bias, about giving death sentences to women. I don't have any knowledge about statistics, but I know of a lot of cases where juries just have a hard time coming back with that death wreck on women. And a great many states have never executed a woman. Florida and Texas, where I've done this, are two that are like that. And I don't think there have been nearly the incidence of women offenders, but when juries are confronted with that, they're just not prepared to come back and do that. And I think another way that this bias shows up is when the victim is white and the perpetrator is black. The people who do this business tells you juries are overwhelmingly prepared to come back with a death recommendation or sentence on the black offender. And that's one of the areas where there is the most racism in the administration of the death sentence. There's also the question of a charging decision on the part of a prosecutor. I think prosecutors have to make the decision to charge a woman with a capital offense with an idea in mind of whether juries in their jurisdiction are ever going to give a death sentence. And I think a lot of times they come back and say no, so they don't charge them with capital offenses.
Do you have the same kind of information as Mr. Gillespie, that this is a one-on-one ratio for arrest for homicide?
I don't have any information on that. I don't. I would recommend to you a book by a woman named Ann Jones called Women Who Kill. She's kind of a feminist historian, and she's got a bit of that theme through the book, that culturally there have been a lot of serious women offenders, and society from the beginning in this country has just not been prepared to see them in the same way that we see male offenders in the same kind of conduct.
Do either of you have information about the reasons that women kill? Do they kill into self-defense, the women who are arrested for homicide? Is there a self-defense motive here, or?
My guess would be that women who, the majority of women who are charged with homicide are charged in domestic situations, and generally the law is that those are not capital kinds of situations. But that's just an intuitive guess. It's not based on any statistics I've studied.
Do you want to just line up behind the microphone?
This is not a question for either of you, because it may not be. It's a moral outrage. It's one of mine. I have taught in a small university in Alabama, so I've seen the things you're talking about. And that was one. I mean, we used to work that. But in addition, there was another moral outrage. I taught when the Vietnam War was on. And how many of my students came back, or didn't come back, and there was never any outrage about this because some corporation did not make the right things in their guns, or the planes didn't fly, and they would kill hundreds at a time. And never, no one ever, that was just business. And yet they... It could be proved that what they did with the people who were over these departments put them up a level higher. That I don't think anyone has enough. That's that.
Just a comment in reference to the lady before this speaker. It was interesting to see the sexist response of the audience as the lady asked the question, could it be possible that this is true? And her sexist response as well, without even perhaps realizing that's what it was.
I'm here covering this for my newspaper. I'm not LDS, but we face the same issue in our church as I attend an evangelical church, and I'm personally very much opposed to the death penalty, but find that a lot of my fellow church members are for it. And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Driggs, since you're in Texas and Florida where evangelicalism is strong, with the rise of the religious right, do you fear a trend, although the Supreme Court is getting more moderate to liberal appointments, but do you fear a trend where we're going to be executing more people for even less heinous crimes?
Well, legally, we're clearly headed in that direction. In Texas, where I'm at, we executed 17 last year. We've executed so far this year 8. We could possibly hit 17 again this year. We've got 388, I think, on our death row right now, which is the largest in the country. There's this trend to make more and more offenses capital and to sort of open the process up so that you make more people death eligible, which is sort of the political response to crime. But I'm optimistic in that I think in the abstract, if we start seeing a lot more executions, and inevitably we're going to see some where it's clear that this person was innocent. There's a situation arising on a case in Texas where I'm afraid that may happen, and it's going to cause a lot of unrest in Texas if this guy is executed. And the cost of the death penalty goes up, because it's costing literally $2.5 to $3 million a shot to execute these guys. I think somewhere along the line, some public policy considerations on cost and a few other factors are going to begin to retard support for the death penalty. Lawyers in my business, trial lawyers, and I do just what lawyers call post-conviction, which is sort of the secondary set of appeals, habeas corpus. But trial lawyers that we advise have learned that in smaller, less financially stable rural counties, the way to stop a death trial in its tracks is to make that prosecution as expensive and difficult for the state as you can. You file motion after motion after motion. You fight them on everything. You know, and sometimes this prosecutor just finally says, all right, you know, and he says it because the county commissioners called him and said, we can't afford to have to raise property taxes in this county for you to get a death sentence on this guy. So my feeling is while the politics opens it up, I think the cost of it and people's opposition to taxes is going to get the death penalty eventually. I think that will be the factor that will bring it to a stop in this country.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I know that both of you have questions.
Yeah. The question I have is just recently in the Los Angeles Times, they ran a two-day series on a lawyer here in the state of Utah. Have you heard of it? It was a lawyer who basically... What's that?
David Young.
Who basically, as I understand the article, had a client who basically wanted to enter a plea of guilty, knowing full well that his guilty plea would get him the death penalty. Is there ever... the article brought up the question, should lawyers play the game anyways? The game of going through the trial, saying innocent, in the appeals process... Or should a client who is found to be mentally competent be given the punishment if he decides to plead guilty?
That is a very difficult, hot issue in my profession right now. We call them volunteers. And it would take me a whole hour to discuss that. I was on an hour and a half panel in Montreal in June on just that topic. I don't know that we have enough time to get into it much. My personal view is that if the client tells me he wants to plead guilty and get a death sentence, he probably has the right to do it, but he's going to have to find another lawyer. I'm going to withdraw. I'm not going to be part of that.
In regards to an execution, why does it cost so much money to kill a person? I'm personally, I probably sway more against execution and the death penalty, but how much does it cost for a needle and for... the injection or the electric chair. Why it seems like an unbelievable amount of money to kill someone.
Well, a lot of it is the trial is more expensive. When you have a capital trial, the jury selection process has to go into a lot of issues that a non-capital trial don't go into. It takes you longer to pick a jury. You're tying up a courtroom for longer. You generally have two lawyers defending in a capital case as opposed to one. The transcripts are longer. You have a punishment phase, which is a second part of the trial. There are a lot of mental health, psychiatric, psychological, neurological issues that are relevant in the death or life decision in a punishment phase that don't come into play in a regular guilt phase in an ordinary trial. Those experts are costing you $1,000 a day. Then you have a higher level of security in the places these guys are quartered. Florida, for instance, just built a new prison solely for the purpose of housing death row inmates. It's 340 beds, and it is too small before they opened it. It cost them $11.5 million to build, and it cost them $6 million a year to operate just for 340 death row guys. Then in capital cases, you have an automatic appeal to the highest court in the case in the state in a capital trial, which you usually go to intermediate courts on the other kinds of stuff. They go to the Supreme Court more often, and you enter a second phase of appeals called habeas corpus in every capital case, which you rarely do in any other kind of case. All I do is habeas corpus law, post-conviction. And we will sometimes be in habeas corpus two or three times trying to stop this execution. All of that piles up and gets expensive. There's a sort of a systematic problem, too, that relates to this. The Florida Supreme Court, in Florida, you have to appeal every death sentence to the Florida Supreme Court. The Florida Supreme Court now spends 40% of their time on death penalty cases. Everything else they have to deal with is confined to 60% because they are so clogged with these cases. So the whole system kind of backs up and becomes less efficient because of all of this capital litigation in states where it's very popular.
There are two other factors I might mention. One is that they also end up being on death row somewhere 8 to 10 years, 17 years in our last execution here in Utah, which is a part of it. And also that 10 capital punishment trials are held in order to get one to the point of actually having a death sentence and getting to execution. And that's built into the cost factor as well for those who figure the costs. My figure suggests $5 million is more close.
A writ is a legal term for a kind of document. Habeas corpus, actually it's Latin for release the body. You have state habeas corpus and federal habeas. You can only go into federal habeas corpus when there's something in the state system that violates federal constitutional guarantees. So a writ is just what we call the paper. So
Do you want to go real quick? We're out of time. Our last question.
I'll go real quick. You're talking about defendants not having the capacity to conform their conduct with what's normally done, and that's why they shouldn't be executed. But yet, don't you deal with capacity at the guilt phase, at the penalty phase, and again at the appeal phase before that person can be executed? Aren't you dealing with the same factors?
Well, yeah. It's when you're dealing with mental health issues, it's not like you're crazy or you're not. If you're dealing with mental health professionals, you find there's this wide sort of gray zone of people not being able to function or functioning less well. What you're talking about is an innocent by reason of insanity determination or an incompetent to stand trial determination. That is a very, very low threshold. Any defense lawyer would tell you if you have to run an insanity defense, it's because you got no case. You're not going to win an insanity defense. Almost never. And the kinds of things that come up in punishment phase are higher levels of capacity, but there's still sort of a diminished capacity, a reduced ability to make these rational decisions. It doesn't mean you're not guilty. It means that you're not so able to make rational judgments that you're really cold-blooded and that you should be given the death sentence. It's a recognition that you are slower or less able to make good decisions. That's sort of the layman's version of it.
Can we just thank Ken and Kay one last time? Thank you for attending, and I'm sure they'll stick around for questions if you'd like to come up and talk to them individually.
Thanks for tuning in to yet another session of today's Sunstone Symposium coverage. We're coming to you again live from the Salt Lake Hilton, located at 150 West on 500 South in Salt Lake City. We have a couple more sessions during the day coming up, and each hour generally contains about six different sessions. We've been listening this past hour to Ken Driggs, who has a degree in legal history from the University of Wisconsin and who is currently a senior staff attorney at the Texas Resource Center and who has formerly worked as a lawyer for death row inmates in Florida and now has that same capacity in the state of Texas. He has been discussing how ethically, as a Mormon, he looks at the idea of a death penalty, and he is disturbed by problems of mistaken convictions and the problems that human justice encounters and brings about. The response to Ken Driggs' paper was given by Kay Gillespie, who is the author of a book called The Unforgiven: Utah's Executed Men, written a few years ago, and he's also the chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Weber State University. And both men addressed the subject of the death penalty, especially as it relates to the to LDS ethics. Join us again in about 10 minutes. We'll be coming to you again with another session of this symposium, and that'll be beginning, we hope, promptly at 3:30, and there will be one last session broadcast on the radio after that one. We'll be hearing a paper given by Bonner Ritchie, who is an organizational behaviorist and a consultant to Palestinian organizations. A paper that he titles The Quest for Peace in the Middle East. A reminder, of course, that all of these sessions are available on tape and that the five or so other sessions during each broadcast hour that are not on the radio are also available on tape, and you can call the Salt Lake Hilton and ask for the Sunstone Desk at 532-3344. Until we join our next session, The Quest for Peace in the Middle East, at 3:30, we will return you now to the studios of KCPW.